Hey all, it's the No Nay Never podcast with your host, Jamie Smith.
Hello and welcome to this week's No Nay Never podcast. I'm Jamie Smith and joining me today are Adam, Michael and Natalie. Lots and lots to get through as usual. There was a game at the weekend, defeat at Sunderland, but I'm sure we're going to spend most of our time talking about transfer deadline day and the lack of activity from Turf Moor. But we will start with the football, and later we've got Stephen Goldsmith, Sunderland fan, joining us for a little bit as well. But we'll start with the Sunderland game. Burnley not really at the races, it's got to be said. A couple of disappointing results and performances in a row now after the collapse against Palace as well. But we did stay out of the bottom three because everybody else lost, so it wasn't too much of a disaster. Michael, it was a funny one really, but Burnley just didn't really seem to turn up.
Yeah, we didn't look like we were at the race at all on Sunday. It was a team that looked like they had no confidence. Danny Ings all over the shop, his head weren't in it. I don't know, just really, really, really disheartening performance. I was so angry after the game, to be honest.
I went up to Sunderland for the game and I was quite positive ahead of it because I thought we were going to bounce back from the Palace game last week on the podcast. Not last week, before the FA Cup break, we talked about how last season we made a really good habit out of bouncing back from these setbacks, but it seemed to me like the belief had gone a bit out of the side from what happened against Palace, and I think that's got to be a bit of a concern. We are going to have to show a lot of characters to come back from that. Talk a lot about Dash's substitutions on the podcast, but they were probably the strangest ones he's made so far, putting Wallace and Jukovic on and taking off Danny Ings. Ings, obviously, not having his best game, and Dash sort of intimated that he might have been a bit distracted by the speculation linking into Liverpool. But those substitutions seemed a bit, to me, like he was trying to send a message to the board, sort of, if this is all I've got, you need to go and get me some players.
Yeah, I think you're right when you're looking at it like that. Respect. I think I actually saw your comment when you said it's almost as if he was saying to the board, look how short on quality I am. And it was just so odd. Everyone, I think every fan that I saw on Twitter reacting had the same reaction. Like, what was he doing bringing Boyd off? Danny Ings had to come off. He wasn't in it at all. His head was all over. But yeah, it's so strange. So strange.
The Ings one does make more sense because he did seem a little bit distracted, and you could probably make a case for him not actually starting that game. But Boyd instead of Arfield, I could not get my head around that. I thought, I've taken a bit of stick for an article I've written about Arfield's form, where I basically said he should be dropped. But I felt he was really, really poor on Saturday. Both goals came from runs from full-backs that Arfield should have been tracking. Moved him over to the other side and it happened again immediately. He just doesn't seem to be doing his job anymore in that regard, tracking those runs. And I couldn't understand why he was left on the pitch when Boyd was taken off, unless it was a fitness thing. But Arfield wasn't the only... I don't want to pick on Arfield too much. He wasn't the only player who was well off his game.
I was going to say, it's after the Palace game, I singled out Arfield as underperforming in that role of not picking up his man and not giving that cover. And some of them is exactly the same. I don't want to pick on him, but he hasn't been up to scratch for quite a few games now, unfortunately. And it's probably time Dash started thinking about alternative options in that area of the pitch.
It's strange because out wide is probably the area where we do have quite a solid cover. Kiteley's done a reasonably good job when he has played, and even Ross Wallace has done okay in little spells from the bench, so it's not like he's only picking Arfield because there's nobody else. There are other options there. Natalie's in the car, by the way. If you can hear some noise in the background, we'll hopefully be able to tidy that up.
Sorry.
a really disappointing afternoon all round at Sunderland, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's like you say, there just seems to have been a couple of games now with the Palace collapse and the Sunderland games where they've just not looked like themselves, and I don't really understand what's happened.
There was a chance towards the start of the game for Ashley Barnes that I headed not long before someone had opened the scoring. Maybe that could have had an impact on the game. Maybe could have gone a little bit different if that had gone in. I suppose it's hard to say, but we didn't create nothing at all, did we, Michael? It was a bit of a turning point, I suppose, looking back at that header.
Yeah, header probably about it in terms of what we did to create. It was one of them throughout the entire match. We did just did not get into the areas that we needed to be getting into to force the issue, really. You want the team to be digging in and trying to create chances, and we just didn't do it. I'm still really angry about it. Now I'm thinking about it. Now that I'm having to think back to it, I'm getting angry again. Just thinking about how we performed. I was infuriated with it. Just all over the picture. It was so bad.
Just wait till later, Michael, when you get angry.
It was particularly annoying, I think, because it was maybe the best away support I've been a part of in a good while. We were very good at Leicester, but I think in the face of such a bad performance, the strong support from the Burnley away end was absolutely fantastic. And even in the second half, where it became obvious we weren't going to get anything from the game, I think it took a lot of guts from the fans to keep singing and keep supporting the lads, and hopefully that was appreciated with being able to show how much we were still backing them, even though they were playing really, really badly, to be honest. There's no way to dress it up. Burnley just weren't at the races, almost as bad in some ways as West Brom away, in that we didn't have all the players missing that we did at West Brom. I think that made it more understandable than the performance at Sunderland, where I'm the same as you, Michael. I can't quite get my head around why we were so poor. And I think it was one of those that we could probably still be playing that game now and we wouldn't have scored. We had a lot of pressure, but didn't really seem to do that much with it. And when you're putting on Lukas Jukovic, bless him, he's just not a goal threat, is he? We never thought we were going to get back in the game.
I think you could throw Lukas Jukovic an open net and he'd miss at the minute, to be honest. Obviously, he can score goals. He must be able to. He won't be a striker at this level. Well, then again, Heskey were a striker, weren't they? So he hardly ever scored. It's one of them. I'm hoping it's a case of a couple of bad games. After the Crystal Palace game knocked them out, I'm hoping that they just gone out against Sunderland, had a bit of a crap, and then I hope they knuckle down now ahead of West Brom and really put in the performance to repair that faith that the fans have shown in the team. And to get the results, when it's so big now, is that game? It's taken on a new, kind of a new life. In that we need that 3 points essentially.
It's strange, really, because you'd think such a bad performance against Sunderland would have kind of jolted the board and the CEO,
yeah, absolutely,
and whatever to be a bit more liberal with their like, I don't know. I suppose if you've got these budgets and you've got these targets and plans and frameworks and whatever else, you've got to kind of stick to it, otherwise there's no point having them in the first place. But you'd think that, like, such a terrible performance where it's just so uninspiring, we kind of have faith as fans that the team can perform, you'd think such an uninspiring performance would kind of force those at the top to reevaluate with regards to the transfer policy, which we'll come on to in a bit.
Yeah, I think you've got a point, but I don't think there was really anything that happened at Sunderland that was much of a surprise. I mean, we played pretty badly, but it was the weaknesses that we've already seen. Like, we talked about Arfield not tracking his man. He's stopped doing that for the last few weeks. I don't know why. And we defend narrow and we get caught out by that. And Ben Mee plays badly because he's not good enough for the Premier League. We already knew about that. We knew that we couldn't get in behind teams because we don't have any pace going forward. We knew that if Ings doesn't play well, we don't play well. It wasn't really new information in a lot of ways, I don't think. So, although it was a bad performance, and you would say that a lot of clubs would have a reaction to that and go out and get some players, I don't know if it's not like there was new information where we thought, oh, right, well, this is obviously a problem that we can fix immediately. There was no sticking plaster that could come in and be like, right, that's done. We don't have to worry about that anymore. It's the same problems. So, yeah, I don't know if that would have made any difference. But, yeah, we can come on to the transfer window in a little while. We just mentioned the West Brom game there, Michael. We're in this little run of games that are all six-pointers, really, with the QPR game at home and then the Palace game at home, Sunderland away, West Brom away. I think at the start of that run, West Brom at home, sorry, I think at the start of that run we were talking about how many points we needed to take from it. Obviously, we've only got 3 from the 9 so far. Do you think that does make Sunday a must-win game now? I mean, it's still early in the season to be talking about that, but the run of fixtures after this weekend are so horrible until about April. we really need to get points on the board, don't we?
Yeah, definitely. It's one of them. I remember looking back at it in December, and we were saying after Christmas we have that mini international break, and then decent run of games where we hopefully pick up quite a few points, and with the aim of securing the position, a decent position in the league. Like, I just think if we'd have taken 3 points at Crystal Palace, we'd have been in 12th. So I'd say it's must win. But then you look at that horrible run of games, and top teams are always slipping up against those fighting at the bottom, and you just got to hope that when we go into them games, we've got more of bottle, more grit, and more determination that Dyche famously talks about to beat these teams that are scrapping for Europa League and Champions League fourth position, whatever it is, the race fourth spot, what it is nowadays.
I think having taken a point at City, we shouldn't necessarily be writing those games off, but the reality is West Brom home is probably the last game that we can expect to win for a little while, and with it being so tight at the bottom, those 3 points could really give us a boost up the table and get us away from that bottom three that we don't want to be near. We will move on now then to the transfer window in a little while, but earlier today I spoke to Sunderland fan Stephen Goldsmith from the Sunderland podcast Wise Men Say to find out what he thought of the game. Excellent. Right, joining us now is Stephen Goldsmith from the Wise Men Say Sunderland podcast. I suppose from your point of view it was a pretty job well done, is that right?
Well, it was much needed. It certainly wasn't a vintage performance. I think had Ashley Barnes put that header in early on, you know, things might have went the other way. But as it is, got to be happy with it, because as sort of cliche as it sounds, if you want to sort of establish yourself in the Premier League, you need to win games when you're not playing well. And we certainly done that. We're normally on the receiving end of those, to be fair. So very, very, very relieved, I think, because we lost to Hull recently, and we just needed to prove that we could beat the teams around us at home, because second half of the season now, I mean, there's only Southampton in the top eight who we have to play at home. All the rest of the sides are mid-table down. So that's hopefully a positive thing.
The Sunderland game plan seemed to work perfectly. I mean, both of your goals were almost carbon cut. It's really the way you raided down the wings and then got the balls cut across, especially DeForest going. You must be delighted with the way Poyet's changing tactics seems to be coming together at that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the fullbacks are very important to us. Obviously, they are for any side that doesn't employ wingers. It's important that your fullbacks get forward. Now, we've been lucky on the injury front in that respect. Billy Jones is out quite often. Van Arnold's been out. And Riviere, the French lad who set up the first goal, has been out as well. So we've been playing centre-backs in those fullback positions. And that's been a major part of why we haven't been creating as many chances, and we've managed to get ourselves a lot of nil-nils. But I think the thing that I'm happy with the most about the way Poyet set up was when he brought Defoe in, he realised, you know, if this is going to be a quick fix, I need to change the way we play, because he can't really play up front by himself. Now, he tried something at Spurs, he tried something else against Fulham. That one was a disaster. And he's changed it again. And he's I've noticed we've went a little bit more direct than we used to. Which is probably overdue. So you've got to give him credit, because he's trying things. Luckily, if you compare us to Burnley, we're quite lucky, or Burnley, for example, we're quite lucky that our squad, compared to most of the sides down there, is quite strong. And he does have a lot of players, so he can try a few different things. I'm guessing that's not the case for you guys, because you're pretty set up in a certain way. And I don't mean that with any disrespect. You know, you've got to cut your cloth accordingly and all that stuff. And I think Poyet's lucky that he's got a lot of players, a lot of different players he can try different things with, and I think hopefully this could be him stumbling across something that works.
I think that's absolutely right. We basically have no choice but to play the way we do. There's not much Dyche can do differently. Defoe got on the score sheet, but he did miss a really good chance in the second half as well. I suppose how sharp he can be and how many goals he can score, that's going to have a major impact on where you end up this season, isn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Match of the Day pointed it out, didn't they, when they showed you Alador's chance against West Ham where it hit his arse. And, you know, it was from a similar position where Defoe put it in. I think I saw it up against Fulham to sort of figure out that Defoe was going to be okay, because the obvious debate is You know, can you get the service to him? It's no good having somebody, you know, renowned goal scorer in the box if you're not going to get the service to him. And some people were pointing to Stephen Fletcher as an example of that, saying this lad will score your goals if you get it to him, and he's not scoring goals because you aren't getting to him. But I think against Fulham, we saw a few occasions when Defoe sort of got himself on the end of something, which he didn't really have a right to get on the end of, or perhaps none of the other strikers are capable of doing that. He diverted somebody else's shot goalwards, for example, and the goal against you guys, he just knew where to be. I mean, Gomez's ball to Van Aanholt when he overlapped, he does that practically every game. He doesn't do a lot else, Gomez, but he finds Van Aanholt with that through ball, I would say, every game. And I think that's the first time we've possibly scored from it. And that's just because Defoe knew where to be. Right place, right time. Cliche, isn't it? But it's true, I guess.
It's what gets you points to this level, isn't it? Having someone who can stick the ball away. You mentioned Stephen Fletcher there. Obviously, we had him for a year. I was a bit surprised that Conor Wickham played instead on Saturday. His career seems to have gone a little bit sideways the last couple of years, even though he had a strong first year at Sunderland. What's gone wrong for him?
Just struggling to utilise him, I think, to be honest. Martin O'Neill had a system where we played very, very deep. He had Stephen Sessegnon behind him, and it kind of suited him because he's quite creative and tricky, Sessegnon, and he knew where to be, the right place, the right time. And things have just moved on since then. You know, De Canio tried to play an orthodox 4-4-2, which was a disaster. And then Poyet's changed it around again, and I don't know. It's hard to put my finger on it, I could honestly say, because he's liked. He's a talented footballer. He's got a great touch. He's good in the air. He can finish. You know, he should be doing better than he is. It's just, it's hard to really say. It's a bit of a mystery to us all, I think. Regarding Wickham playing over him, I think that's just because the system he played, where Wickham was kind of half coming from the left and half a strike partner for Defoe. And I think you get the work rate off Conor Wickham going backwards, which you don't get from Fletcher. I think that's the only reason Wickham played.
Maybe it's just a question of needing a fresh start somewhere else for Fletcher. Maybe that can get his career going here. It's obviously a big 3 points for you on Saturday then. Are you confident that's going to see you moving up the table again and you'll be able to stay up?
Well, no, not if history's got anything to go by, no. I would like to think so, but this is a frustrating thing about being a Sunderland fan. We just can't seem to get any momentum going, and it's quite difficult to watch at times. We draw at home to all these sides, and we play really nice football, you know, all the top six and seven sides, and we think when the lower league team, or not the lower league, but bottom half of the table come, if we play like that, we'll be all right. And then Hull come, probably the worst team I've seen up here all season, and managed to turn us over 3-1, and that gets you worrying a little bit, as does drawing with Fulham in the cup. So I don't know. Yeah, I would like to see all the usual things. This is going to be a springboard to kickstart things, etc. But you know, it doesn't always work like that. We've got Swansea away the weekend, where, you know, if we can get anything, I think it's a bonus. And then we've got QPR, which would be interesting because they haven't picked up a point away yet. So Sod's Law would say they'll come up here and we'll be the first team to surrender them. But I think if we beat QPR, I would be semi confident we'll be fine, because that'll put us on what, potentially 26 points already. You know, we could only be 10 points away from safety then. And I would just like to avoid relegation with a few games to spare, if that's not too much to ask. But even that, history suggests I'm being optimistic with that, if I'm being honest.
I think this season might well be one where it's quite a low number that keeps teams up. And there's so many sides down there. I think it might end up being 32, 33 even.
Possibly, yeah. We've stayed up on 34 before, where the season Keane walked out. Which was surprising because we had some good players at the time. So you're right, it can be done. That was a year in Newcastle, got relegated as well, so that was okay for us. I guess it depends on QPR, you know, a few factors, doesn't it? Depends on who QPR bring in, what they're going to do. I think everybody down the bottom has got their eye on that, because if you look at West Brom and you look at Crystal Palace, those are two sides who a lot of people are now saying, because of the managers they've brought in, that's going to be enough to sort of propel them away from it, which isn't good because you want as many teams down there as possible, don't you? So I think the QPR one's interesting. I think we're all going to be looking at that and hoping that they make a mess of things there, aren't we?
Yeah, definitely. I'd keep QPR down as one of the three for a while, so definitely hoping they get someone a bit rubbish. Interesting comparison to last year, though, in that the three teams that went down all changed their managers and seem to have no improvement, so can go either way, can't it? Just finally, yeah, then, before we round off, obviously Burnley were quite poor, as Daniel White on Saturday, but have you seen enough of us so far to give any idea about whether you think we're going to be able to stay up?
I would say what I've seen in isolation to, you know, if you take the game on Saturday in isolation, because you didn't play it great, what I've seen enough of you, it's hard to make a compare you to other sides of the stadium alike, because as I said, there's only been Hull from the lower end of the table who's played up here, and Stoke, who we beat quite comfortably. In comparison to Hull, you were much better than Hull. I don't know if you remember the Hull game, we had a couple of Stonewall penalties turned down, and the players, the heads went, which is no excuse. The professional footballers should be able to deal with it, but they couldn't. But I think what I've seen in Burnley in other games, you know, I've watched live a few games. Obviously, I went down to Turf Moor, and you were okay then. I think you'd be okay. I think just the fact that, like we said, you've got a settled and established team, and, you know, you really can't underestimate how valuable that can be, I think, when you compare to someone like QBR, who, whichever manager now goes in there, is going to have all these players not knowing what to do with them. If in the meantime you put two wins together, you know, you're edging further away from them, aren't you? I think you'd be fine. I would like to think you will be, just because you're Northern more than anything, and there's not enough Northern teams in the Premier League anymore, is there?
I agree with you on that one. Well, it's good to end on a positive note, so we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us, Stephen. That's Stephen Goldsmith from the Sunderland Podcast Wise Men Say. So that was Stephen Goldsmith from the Sunderland Podcast Wise Men Say. He was obviously a lot happier with the game than we were. Hopefully we'll be able to maintain a little bit of upbeatness for the next bit of the podcast, but I wouldn't hold your breath, I'm afraid, because we're all going to have to talk about deadline day. After the game on Saturday, Sean Dyche said, and I quote, "We've got money. However, Burnley managed to spend none of it whatsoever. No players arrived at Turf Moor on deadline day. And in fact, it meant that the squad was actually weaker than at the start of the window because of the departure of Nathaniel Shelbos. Michael Keane was the only signing, and of course he was already at the club." Michael, if we start with you then, it's almost unbelievable, isn't it, that the weaknesses in the squad were so obvious, and yet we've done absolutely nothing to arrest them.
Yeah, it's, if I'm looking at it, I wanna say, like, oh, I'll get the good news out of the way first. It's one end, deal with some good news first. Michael Keane signing permanently, great bit of business early on. Thought this is going to be a great window. We'll be able to get in a centre midfielder to give us that extra depth in midfield that Shalbar unfortunately wasn't providing, because he wasn't good enough, whatever. We urgently needed it, hoping for maybe centre back for that extra depth again. One or two positions I'd like to see someone else, maybe a left back of decent quality, unless Ward suddenly recovers. But then nothing happened, and it was almost, I don't want to use the word farcical, but that's how it felt at times when we were unwilling to go to 1.6 million for a player that was nominated for Scotland Young Player of the Year. It's them type of deals that really, really, really just wow me up.
We can come on to some of the players mentioned in a little while. Natalie, if we can bring you back in, what's your feeling a couple of days after
I'm here,
after deadline day?
I'm still fuming.
Still really angry.
I'm still really annoyed. I'll tell you, I feel like if this was a video podcast, I'd have to wear the expletive warning t-shirt Alec in Sears, just to warn everybody of the language that may come out of my mouth.
All right, we'll bleep it out.
I'm angry. I'm genuinely angry. Okay. No, I genuinely am, all joking aside, furious. It's like, how has this situation happened? How have we put ourselves in a position where our Premier League survival is down to chance? All we're hearing is, well, you know, don't forget the squad that got us up there, and, you know, don't forget the players who've done so well so far. Nobody's questioning that. And not one Burnley fan that I've seen has said, this team isn't good enough, we're not going to do anything, we've got to enforce. We are flogging the same 11 players every week. They're not getting a rest. There's no competition for places. And the squad needs changing. You know, we've no impact players. How many times have we looked at trying to change a game, and you look at the bench and go, nah, well, that's not going to happen. And I'm astonished that a professional business has put itself in this position.
I was waiting for you to write in.
Yeah, it's, I had to stop myself just in case I carried on for the rest of the night.
I'm still almost baffled by it, really. Like, I was annoyed last night, partly because we'd done the live blog, and spent about 4 hours, even when I hadn't finished work for the day, spent about 4 hours doing this blog, and there was basically no reason to do it at all because we didn't sign anyone. Apparently got nowhere near signing anyone, but I just, we've had all months to plan for this, and to not sign a single player, I just don't get it. Adam, what are your thoughts?
Last night I tweeted quite a lot. I was quite angry, as were most fans. I'm actually quite glad that I had the live blog and the Twitter feed to distract me, because I was just spending the evening looking for GIFs, like trying to entertain everyone. Which then Andy Devaney rudely criticised our quote inane animations.
Oh no, that's out of order.
Yep.
They're the best things.
That's why Andy's not on the podcast
tonight,
don't worry. We've gone on it, never had to.
Yeah,
sack Andy.
It's all Andy's fault.
Yeah, but I tweeted, we've got a whole recruitment department. We've got recruitment staff, and we've got...
No, we haven't.
Well, we've got one guy at least. One guy whose job title is head of recruitment. And that should mean that we recruit people, not just sign people on that they're already in the squad. And it just astonishes me that there's, like, we found no one. There's not, I don't know, it's not as if we haven't had any time to prepare. We knew that the window in the summer was bad. We knew that we needed to improve in this window, yet we haven't even, I don't know, we haven't seemed to got our ducks in a row. We haven't tried to hit the ground running. I mean, we almost did that with Keenan. I think I said on this podcast that hopefully this is a sign of things to come, and hopefully we've learnt from our mistakes in the summer. And it's not as if the summer window was just criticised a bit like afterwards. It was frankly embarrassing during the whole window, and it shouldn't have happened again, and it has. And it's quite hard to decide where to throw your blame. Kevin.
No, it's not. Well, it's quite easy.
No. But there's a number of parties that you can blame. You can blame Dyche because he's the one apparently setting the valuations of the player.
I'm picking the targets initially. Yeah.
Yeah. You can blame Lee Darnborough, who's the head of recruitment, because that's his bloody job title. You can blame the CEO because he hasn't actually got anything to occupy his time anymore, because David Baldwin's been brought in to reduce his commercial Lee Hughes's commercial activity. And then you can blame the board for not giving the money and allocating the funds that are needed to survive at Premier League level and get the players that we need. So it's quite hard to decide where to squarely lay the blame. I mean, they're the parties. We can blame all of them, I guess. But yeah. I think Kevin, in his article for the site called "Lack of January Deals is a Disgrace," I think he found it quite hard to kind of list one person. And then people started commenting saying, well, why aren't you blaming Dyche? Because we don't really know what the situation is. Who is the one party that we need to change?
The book stops somewhere, doesn't it? I mean,
well, yeah.
There's no transparency over how the process works, and hopefully we'll be able to clear that up. We did approach the club to see if we'd get somebody on the podcast tonight. Didn't expect to get a yes, to be honest, and the answer was no. But hopefully we'll get to speak to Lee Hughes soon. I believe he's going to talk to the local press this week, God. So we might get some answers.
But it's quite clear from the club's point of view who's to blame. You know, if you read some of the initial responses coming out of the club, the fans are obviously to blame for this. You know, we're just not being positive enough. You know, we're not being 100%. How dare we? You know, we're supposed to have 1,000% blind faith in the squad that we've got and the players who got us promoted and the board that are running the business and keeping us secure for the next 459 years. So it's obviously our fault.
We're all just too short-termist.
Oh. Yeah, it goes without saying that if we'd sent some more enthusiastic tweets yesterday, then more deals would have got over the line The negotiators would have suddenly got much better at their
jobs. Absolutely. Do you know what gets me, though, from last night? There was nothing from the club. We found out
That's very frustrating.
From the local journalist who...
Bowden, whose birthday it was. Exactly. And he was in a pub drinking.
It's a week off my birthday. And there's been no statement either. We're doing the podcast almost 24 hours after the deadline calls, and there's been no word from the club at all.
Well, we can go to the club shop and buy our brand new third kit for £40.
Yeah, the terrible shiny tinfoil kit. Yeah,
exactly. We've got to keep the funds. Come on.
And, honestly, I'm kind of in charge of getting guests on for the podcast. And I did try and find people who had the opposite view. But there are so few of them. I know Andy Devaney wrote a piece for the site, and he said he didn't really care, basically, that we hadn't got anyone in. But from our comments, there are about three people. We've had like 75 comments on Kevin's article, and there are about 3, 4, or 5 maybe at a push that actually don't care about this.
I think it's a very naive view to look at it and say we did not need a centre midfielder, because if Jones or Mane, either of them pick up an injury, which we saw with Vaux against Leicester, so easy and innocuous, that happens, bang, and who's going into centre midfield then? People saying pulling Arfield, he's played there before, he's been rubbish. Reed, no thanks. It's just options.
Not only is Arfield rubbish, but he's been playing first team consistently in a different position. So who are you going to get to fill his position?
Exactly.
Matt Taylor's not even back yet, and I suppose Keightley could go there, but apparently Keightley's not good enough to start anyway because Dyche isn't picking him.
Well, the thing with Arfield is that people say he's a central midfielder, but for me, when he's played there, he's been a disappointment, apart from the one game at Leicester where, in fairness, we had a patched-up team. Arfield played central midfield with Ward. They both played quite well, and we somehow escaped with a point. But they're counting Arfield as central midfield cover when, as you say, he's already in the team. They're counting Ward as central midfield cover when he'll be in the team when he's fit. They're counting Taylor as central midfield cover when he hasn't kicked a ball for about 4 months.
And at this level,
Stephen Reid, he's played one game in central midfield this season, which we lost 4-0.
Quite frankly, at this level, we shouldn't be thinking, oh, we can patch the team up if we get an injury.
Players can do a job. It's an absolute nonsense. Like, we needed a specialist midfielder.
The majority of championship clubs will have more than two central midfielders on their books. And we're a Premier League club, and we've got the windfall. And I hate to turn this into money, but we've had the windfall, and we will get the compensation that you get for getting promoted. But apparently it's not about that. We're just trying to save the club from oblivion if we go down. But the problem is with that approach is you end up going down because you are saving the club from oblivion. Like, it's just I don't envy the club because it is a very hard balance to get, but surely there's something that can be done that's not this approach and not, frankly, quite embarrassing as a fan to deal with.
Well, there has to be the middle ground, don't there? I mean, none of us are talking about betting the ranch, as they like to say, and spending £20 million on players or whatever. But also, there has to be more than nothing and not bringing any players in. There has to be a middle ground there. And I think it was quite interesting to read Brendan Flood's comments on Twitter today, because he was talking about the need for stability. And remember the last time we were in the Premier League, Brendan Flood later said we were probably overly cautious.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like we've basically done exactly the same thing again. I mean, we'll come on to some of the players that appear to have been targets, but to not be able to spend any money, to not even be able to get a loan in, I think that was, for me, that was minimum expectation. With Shelbar going out, we had to get at least a loan in to replace him, otherwise we were worse off and we couldn't even do that. So, as we've said already, an injury to a central midfielder now, and it leaves us in a very difficult position, and I just feel bad for Sean Dyche because I think he's been really, really let down. A couple of players coming in could have made such a big difference, and as it is, he's got the same squad that's looked dead on the feet for the last two games, really. Don't want to be critical of the players because they have got us as far as they have, but it's difficult to see how we can turn it around from that.
Do you know what? As well, what really gets me is that we went through all of this 12 months ago, and I know the situation was a bit different, but I remember sitting on this podcast 12 months ago when we were utterly frustrated that we did hardly anything in the January transfer window again, and we were pushing for promotion. And do you know, we got lucky last year and that paid off, but we can't just keep building this business on luck. you know, we got Barnes in, and fair enough, there's Barnes splits opinion, and I know he doesn't. My opinion certainly changed of him this season. But, you know, he was brought in as replacement, and as soon as the January transfer window shut, players were dropping left, right and centre. And I remember when we went to Barnsley that Tuesday night, and it was horrible because you just didn't know who was going to take a knock next. Hello, 12 months later, we've done exactly the same thing. Like, did they not learn in that club?
It's not just 12 months, though. It's three windows in a row that they've done this.
Yeah, it is.
Something has to give. Do you know what I mean? Three windows in a row. Utterly poor targeting of players. Not willing to put the money.
Awful.
It's quite strange, really, because both Sean Dyche and Lee Hughes are supposedly obsessed with statistics and obsessed with almost like the small margins and what we can do to improve and these little things you can improve as a club that get you so far. But if that's not... Like, if Sean Dyche and Lee Hughes aren't... Like, they've been here for the entirety of those three windows and nothing's changed, then what actually... How does this situation get any better? If they're not improving now, then when will they ever improve? Like, that is what I'm saying.
Because... This is our best chance to make that improvement. We are never going to be, unless we stay up this season by that luck and we ride our luck and this squad, by some miracle, keeps us up. This is our best chance. We are at our richest that we've ever been.
Yeah, ever. Not just in the last 10 seasons, but ever. Like,
ever.
Because the finances have just exploded in the last few years. As in the Premier League finances.
Yeah, even more than it's ever been. Yeah.
And now we're not even really willing to take a... Like, we're taking more of a risk by not taking any risks. That is the...
Oh, it's ridiculous.
It's just a real conundrum as a fan. And it just makes me angry, as you can tell. And Natalie, and Jamie, and Michael.
I was going to say one thing that's really, really annoyed me, and I don't know about other people, but we don't even seem to have looked beyond now. We don't look to have looked at bringing any young player like before, when we spent £1 million to bring Danny Ings in. We knew Danny Ings were gone in the summer.
There's no planning ahead, is there?
Yeah, yeah. Where's the plan for next year? Who's coming in to replace Danny Ings when he goes in the summer? Because let's face it, we all know he's going to Liverpool more than likely in the next couple of weeks. Something will get signed, won't it? Where's that forward planning? It's what's happened to the club in that respect.
Yeah, exactly. We used to be quite good at that, didn't we? Because obviously Ings was there, ready when Austin left, and Austin was there when Rodriguez went, and Rodriguez was there when Fletcher went, and you can trace it back, and we have planned ahead, and you've got to give credit for that, but we do seem to have stopped doing that. I mean,
Can I just denounce a bit? There is some kind of nasty vibe to some of the things being tweeted at club staff, and I don't think that's necessary.
I agree.
We've managed on this podcast to criticise the club without being nasty and not saying personally hurtful things, and also targeting people. Like, I know Darren Bentley deals with a lot of stick, and that's part of his job, quite frankly. But there is no need to get into a long argument about the nuances of his tweet. And I mean, I did this in the summer after the Twitter fiasco, the ticket fiasco, and the rage over the retainer. But in hindsight, that there is no need for it, because he can't do anything. His job is to
yeah. I mean, Darren, you've got to remember as well, Darren's a fan.
Darren is a fan, and he's actually quite a nice guy. Like, he's a really, very personal guy, and he's got to deal with this stick that's been thrown at him by all sorts of people. And I mean,
he shouldn't have to do that, though. Why is he fronting this by himself?
Exactly. That was the problem in the summer, is that no one stood up. Lee Hughes was on a plane when the retainer press release went out.
It reminds me of President Bush flew over the hurricane. Which one was it? When I can't think of it, in the south. And he just flew over and watched
Katrina.
Other people stuff. That was Lee Hughes. That's the one. And Lee Hughes was just flying over Burnley, waving at us.
One of the last tweets that I sent last night was Comical Ali. You remember the Iraq spokesman?
Yeah.
He was saying, like, there's no Americans in Iraq. It's the tanks coming down the street behind him. It feels like any club spokesman just in that situation now. Yeah. It's like, everything's fine.
Yeah.
Everything's going to be fine, when obviously it's not.
It's not, yeah. And the only official announcement that we've had from anybody in any form of capacity was that first thing this morning, Brendan Flood came out and just said, yeah, nothing to do with me. Yeah. Basically, his tweet was like, don't blame me. I don't have any control. Yeah.
I just tweeted a YouTube link of Shaggy, it wasn't me. And it was just like.
But that's awful. And then at the same time, Daz Bentley, he's having to front this by himself, take personal abuse both through the official club Twitter page and his personal Twitter page. It's like, do you know what? The club officials have to take responsibility for this. Lee Hughes has to come out and front it and man up.
Yeah. There needs to be some transparency there where they say, look, if it is down, you have to remember this could be down to any reason. It could be unrealistic demands from a championship midfielder.
Every deal is different as well.
Yeah, you could have some agent asking ridiculous clauses, saying, oh, I want X, Y, and Z, I want a house in bloody Worley that's worth $500,000 or something. And it'd be good if the club just come out and went, look, at the end of the day, we went for X, Y, and Z, we offered this amount, and they rejected it for these reasons. And that has helped sedate it a bit. People have got, I can see why you've actually pulled out of that, because that's a ridiculous deal.
Yeah, I've read today that there'll be a short statement in the coming days, and that was on Daz Bentley's Twitter.
How long does it take?
Yeah, and it's like waiting for the storm to die down. But the problem is, the storm is only going to get worse. We're only going to get more angry. This is 24 hours after,
I've said this on the site already. Andy's piece was very much like, look, you've got to look at the big picture. We're in the Premier League, so on. And I accept that. But people have to get the chance to vent. But by creating this sort of, it's almost the black call where there's nothing being said by the club to calm it down.
Retainer all over again.
Yeah, builds up. And I'm worried that unless someone comes out and fronts up this week, there'll be fury at the game on Sunday. And that's the last thing that anyone needs. We need 100% support at the match. So people have to feel like they're being listened to now. Otherwise, they'll take Sunday as the opportunity to do that. And
we had a hilarious comment. It was hilarious, ridiculous. It was like totally, kind of out of proportion. But it was kind of just, it was demonstrative of that situation. It was mentioned throwing unfinished pies and rotten tomatoes at the board or something. And it was hilarious. But the thing with this situation is, something similar might happen. We might get, some strange chant going about, because people were disgruntled. Since the retainer, it's very hard to get the fans back on track, because the problem is once you alienate the fans once and you don't repair it, you're then skating on very thin ice for eternity almost until you do something really, really productive and helpful. So the problem is that now this has happened, there is no leeway. There's no flexibility in the fans' opinions, because in the back of my mind, I'm like, well, obviously the club don't care about the fans because of the whole retainer gate and the whole ticket situation. And that's not really right for me to think that, but it's what happens because you don't ever repair the kind of fractures that appear in the first place.
Yeah, well, we could talk about this sort of stuff all the time, but I think we should move on and talk a bit more specifically about some of the players who were involved. There were quite a lot of names that came out, and obviously it's difficult to ascertain exactly which ones were targets, but from the sources that we've seen and the reliable journalists that we've got, it's fair to say that Graham Dorans, Stuart Armstrong, Henry Lansbury and Matt Jarvis were all targets at one point or another yesterday alone. So if we start with Dorans then, it seemed like we offered a couple of million for him.
Yeah, well, it was
Norwich offered four, but he didn't actually go to Norwich in the end.
It was a strange one because we assumed all day that we'd lost out to Norwich, which was a kind of offensive to fans in the first place.
Yeah, kicking the balls.
And then the deadline passed, and we went.
We missed out to
minute.
Nobody. Yeah,
we missed out to literally nobody on let alone a championship player. That was quite perplexing, really. Yeah. But
the thing on the Dorans one, I've already made a couple of excuses on behalf of the club on this one, in that it's not really in West Brom's interest to sell to us as a direct relegation rival, especially with us playing on Sunday. Like, it'd be classic football, wouldn't it, if we bought Dorans from them and then he scored the winner. like on Sunday, so I can kind of understand why they wouldn't want to sell. But having tried to deal with West Brom in the summer over Craig Dawson, seeing how difficult it was to get a deal done there, to then go in for Dorans, who we must have known about all month, to go in on deadline day with an offer that was never going to get accepted, just seems really naive to me. And people said he's overpriced at 4 million. I think you need to get real, because we paid 3 million for George Boyd. Premier League players cost that money. 4 million was not overpriced for Graham Dorans. That's about what he should have cost.
Yeah, it's almost like going back to when we signed Ian Moore for a million and people are like, oh, £1 million. It's like massive money.
David Whitney pointed out that that was 15 years ago.
People are still expecting us to pay £1 million.
It's like, yeah, Ian Moore was £1 million. We'll come on to Stuart Armstrong next. He went to Celtic for £1.6 million. 5 years ago, we paid that for Leon Court. And he's terrible. So how can we not afford to pay that for one of the best young players in Scotland? It's insane.
The reason behind it was odd.
We spent less this season than we did in the Premier League the first time. And our squad wasn't strong enough then. And the prices have risen exponentially since then.
And we should have twice the money, in theory.
Exactly. It's
just, we spend less money.
I don't know. I'm getting a bit exhausted here because it's hard to... As much as people commenting on the site and tweeting at us all the time, we don't actually like criticising the club. It's not a nice thing to do because we actually like the club, believe it or not. But it's actually quite hard not to criticise the club in situations like this, because if we didn't criticise the club, we wouldn't be doing our job as a site, reflecting opinions. Someone actually commented earlier on the site saying that we weren't being, there was no positivity tweeted yesterday, and it's not like we should artificially increase the amount of positivity we do, because
we talk about balance quite a bit, don't we? But balance doesn't mean 50% positive, 50% negative. Balance means you're trying to represent all the views that are out there. And you can only do that if there's views across the spectrum. So on the site today, I think we've got four new pieces, and one of them is positive while the other three are broadly negative. And I think that's probably about right. That's about as much as we could have done today.
Yeah. There's actually five new pieces today.
I've lost count. We're so productive here and on and out that I can't all the content that's going on the site. The other big one that seems to have been a goer at one point was Henry Lansbury. Now, this is a funny one to start with, because it was reported in the summer, and again, we can only go off what's been in the papers and stuff here. We never claim to be in the know, ITK, etc. So we can only tell you what's out there. But it was reported quite widely that we'd been in for Lansbury in the summer and that Forest had turned down £4 million for him. Now, the news that came out yesterday was that we're offering £3 million for him. So apparently, we thought we could get him for less than the turndown in the summer. Now, I know they've just sat the manager, and I know the negotiator at Forest has gone as well, but it just seems like we're trying our luck with that one. It just seemed a bit desperate.
Do you know what's odd with it as well? When he turned us down, he signed a 3-year contract.
Exactly, so he should be worth more money, if anything.
Yeah, because you're buying out that contract. Maybe it's the club have looked at it and gone, oh, well, they've failed financial fair play. They're under a transfer embargo. They might be willing to sell him on the cheap to us. They're not going to do that. They're not going to sell an asset that they could get more money for on the cheap. It's just so counterproductive, especially when they've got ambitions to get into the Premier League, so then they can get more money into the bank, so they're not under an embargo. It's ridiculous.
I know it's been said he's not had a particularly good season, and yeah, fair enough. So if that's the case, why are we still going for him? We obviously still thought he was good enough to add to the squad, be competition for Jones and Marnie, if not to come straight into the side. So find out if he's going to be available and either pay the money or find a new target. Like, why are we messing around with bids that are never, ever going to get accepted? Like, they didn't even need to fax that offer through to Forest or whatever it is they do these days. They could have just asked me and I'd have said, no, they're not going to accept that. It could have saved everyone a load of time. It's just pointless, completely pointless. And that's why I wonder about the professionalism, if you will, of the negotiators. And I know that's a strong word to use, but it doesn't really seem like they're up to it. Getting these big deals done in the Premier League, look at the deals that we've done. We've got a lot of players who were pretty much unwanted came in the summer, players that probably no other Premier League club would have wanted, players like Lucas Jukic, Marvin Sordell, who were outcast at Championship clubs, so fair enough, they'd have jumped at the chance. George Boyd, probably the only one that stands out, and I think Hull probably made a bit of a mistake letting him go. They could probably do with him. So was it about 10 players we signed in the summer? There's only one that I think really took any negotiation. And it seems like there's a problem in the chain somewhere.
You talk about the professionalism there, but I actually wonder whether those responsible for negotiation actually think this is a failure. Because we've not seen any acknowledgement of that. The last window wasn't a failure, according to what you read. And although it's obviously an unmitigated disaster for the club, do they actually think that they've done something wrong? Is there going to be any actual public effort to almost repair the damage that's done?
We've talked about Darren, and he said in a reply to someone that there's going to be... it's going to be mentioned in the programme at the weekend, which seems like a particularly old school way of doing it, but there's going to be something from one of the chairmen in the programme at the weekend, so presumably there'll be something said before then, because I think it's a bit ridiculous to let it go for
the whole week. I think Dan Black at the Express is talking to Lee Hughes on Thursday or Friday. I'm not sure, but I think that's the case.
Yeah, so we should hear something before then, but yeah, we've already talked about how this can just build up. And for me, I from my point of view, I want doing this podcast to be a bit of a line under it. From my point of view, I don't want to be talking about transfers
for
the rest of the week. So I don't know if the club thinks that it's all just going to go away after a bit, but I'm not sure that's really the case. And just wanted to get you two's views on something else, actually. I was talking about particular players. One of the players whose name came up, and I must stress that this was never, ever a rumour. I keep reading on a certain message board and on Twitter that this was a rumour. It was not a rumour. Tim Cahill was not a rumour. Some people suggested that Tim Cahill might be a good signing. That's what happened. And then people read that and went, we're being linked with Tim Cahill. No, it's not the same. So clear that up right away. Tim Cahill, never a rumour. Right. So now we can talk about Tim Cahill.
Definitely.
Well, I think Jamie quite clearly thinks that wasn't a rumour, guys.
Yeah, definitely.
However, that said, I think Tim Cahill would have been expensive, yes, but also perfect.
Yeah. I mean, like, he had the link, the thing that almost made it a rumour.
Yeah, about a million years ago he played with Sean Dyche at Millwall.
And I don't really know. It's hard with these things, because it's hard to get your head around the fact that it would actually ever happen. It's hard to get your head around the fact that the club might actually take a bit of a gamble on these.
Listen, I don't even think it would have come across their mind for a second to even ask the question about someone like Tim Cahill. But apparently he's gone to a Chinese club for $2 million a year, which sounds like a lot of money, but it's actually not that much money in the grand scheme of things. If Tim Cahill had, hypothetically, come to Burnley and scored half a dozen goals and kept in the Premier League, $2 million quid is absolutely nothing. And yes, there were a lot of clubs wanting him, but it's the sort of player that I think we should have at least thought about.
Yeah, and you were laughed out of the park for
Darren Fletcher. Yeah, and it's the same thing. It's like, how are we going to be an established Premier League club if we're not willing to go after players who've got that Premier League experience?
I hate to bring it back to the tickets yet again, but we're charging mid-table plus prices for tickets. So why aren't we getting that product as fans? Like, that's not what I don't understand.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, Lee Hughes was very keen to say it was an average sort of Premier League price, and I think from some of the price we've seen, that's about right. Although, I think it's probably on the higher side of average, to be honest, if you looked at them all. I know the away games we've got coming up, it's like Liverpool and Man United and stuff like that, and Chelsea, they're all about 40, 50 quid, and it's 40 quid to watch them at Turf Moor. So, yeah, fair enough. But also, most of the away games I've been to this season have been less than 30, and it cost me 35 to go to the Turf. So I do think there is a bit of a difference there as well. But yeah, you're right. You can't say, on one hand, oh, we're charging these prices because it's average for the Premier League, and then have a 3 million player as the biggest signing who was unwanted by a Premier League club. Which and then your next biggest signing, is Lukas Jukovic, who wasn't wanted.
I love Thomas Pickles on the site today. So he's our big name signing because he's got 10 letters in his name. that's how it ends up working out.
Our marquee signing was actually the marquee.
I don't know. I'd say you have to look at a different way as well with Cahill. Yes, 2 million for him would have been... I'd happily pay him 2 million wages, but then would the club want to risk breaking the wage structure, whatever that may be, and perhaps alienating one or two other players who might look at that and go, well, why is he on 50-60 grand a week?
Yeah, but with all due respect, those players aren't anywhere near the pedigree or the experienced or the big name that Tim Cahill is. And as professional footballers, they should be able to deal with that. And if it's quite a problem. Whoa.
Professional footballers dealing with that.
Well,
yeah. Nah, I'll see what Michael means. Well, we know how petty and silly they can be.
Yeah,
just to do a little bit of very quick maths, 2 million a year works out just under 40 grand a week. So it's probably twice what our top earners are on.
Yeah.
However, Tim Cahill scored a hell of a lot of Premier League goals. He's still scoring goals at international level for Australia. He was performing very well in the World Cup last summer. I need to clarify that this is obviously all hypothetical.
Yeah, well, this
and
never
it was never
happen.
A rumour. And it was never, ever going to happen. But I think that's the quality player that we should have been trying to get in. Instead of faffing around for players like Henry Lansbury, and they were never going to come. I'd like Graham Dorans, but it was never on the cards either. It just seems.
And the last one
that we haven't even mentioned yet was the winger from West Ham, Matt Jarvis, whose name came up in the last hour. And like, never in a million years going to get Matt Jarvis, and people whinge at me for suggesting Darren Fletcher and Tim Cahill.
It's
Jarvis smacked of desperation for me.
It was just like an hour left.
So it fall through the wind.
When you're playing football manager and you're like, oh god, I need to get someone. Just anyone. It was never ever going to happen. It felt almost like the press lads were fed a name so they had something to say, but it just looked daft like half an hour later when they went, no, actually there's nothing happening. And it was like, oh, Matt Jarvis, yeah, we're being linked with Matt Jarvis, that's great. Oh, nothing's happening. So it's almost like a kick in the teeth. That's happening.
It's like you talk about all this, and then the word ambition comes up a lot.
No ambition.
And like, I've always kind of sighed at that kind of line. Oh, we've obviously got no ambition. But you have to wonder if you have got a strict wage structure and you're not willing to break it for anyone at all, then at what point do you actually accept you're a Premier League team? When does that change?
Exactly. I mean, you can't have Premier League players if you're not going to pay them Premier League wages, essentially. And I understand our budget is the smallest in the league by a difference, but we're talking about a couple of players who might make the difference and earn us, what is it, 60, 70 million extra or something in the summer. And I think you're right when you mentioned the TV money and how much more it's gone. Yes, it's still all going in the pockets of the players and the agents and that, but I think if you're in the exclusive club at this point, I think you're pretty much set. I think the Premier League's going to become even more of a closed shop than it has been so far, and it's going to be harder for clubs like us to get in there. But if we can be in there when the doors get shut, then fantastic. And it just doesn't seem like they've thought of that.
I don't know. I think we're starting to go round in circles because we actually haven't got anyone that disagrees on this podcast now.
Yeah, there's no answers either, so round it up shortly. But I think if I can try and sum it up, I think the frustration is we don't know who's responsible, we don't know where it's gone wrong, we just know that it's gone wrong. I think that's why we're all so annoyed. And we're all annoyed because we want the best for the club. And we've got to stress that because, as Adam says, we don't just want to be negative for the sake of it. If we can end on a slightly positive note, if anyone has managed to stick with us for an hour of complaining.
Oh, God. Sorry, you've had to listen to my cold, ridden voice.
Hopefully next week's podcast will be a bit more upbeat. But the one bit of positive business that we did do was holding on to Danny Ings. And I've said that this is almost minimum expectation, given that the club had repeatedly said that he wasn't going anywhere. But outsiders might think Burnley have done well sold on to Danny Ings. Liverpool were sniffing around him.
Yeah, so Quinn
surely that's something that we can. Is that something that we can grasp a little bit? That's what Andy was saying on the site, isn't it? That Ings is so important, and at least we managed to hold on to it.
Yeah, I think there's an argument to say that. I suppose we're already finding ourselves in a worst case situation, effectively. But I think if Danny Ings went as well, then we might as well just pack up and go home, right? I'm glad it's not worse. And I think Nathan Rogers, who's regularly on the podcast, he was tweeting pictures of Shebby Singh saying it could be worse, guys. We could have Shebby Singh in charge.
Yeah, I hate that argument, though.
Rovers under Shebby Singh actually signed players. I'm going to get some stick for that comment, but the day when you think that Lee Hughes is a worse negotiator than Shebby Singh,
I think that's an indication of where we've gone. But Michael, holding on to Ings is going to be vital, isn't it? If he had gone, that would have basically been accepting relegation. So how much credit does the board deserve for that? There must have been interest. We heard all the stuff about the sales of the ball going back, which was apparently against the rules.
Yeah, there were interest as well from, well, rumoured interest, I say, reported from Man City, Tottenham, teams abroad looking at him. So he's been linked to a lot of big clubs, so I don't know how much of it is down to the player himself, and perhaps even Sean Dyche is the one that needs the praise, aiming at him. He's probably put his arm around him and said at one point, look, Danny, you're going to get this big move in the summer. You're going to go on and to big things, but now was not the right time for it. Going and playing a bit part at this part at this stage in your development, you need to be getting games. Another three, four months in the Premier League, playing week in, week out, putting yourself in that shop window, it'll earn you a lot more money. And it's fair play, board have done well. It's almost, I guess you could say, it's kind of like keeping him. It is a big deal. I'm going to try and convince myself it worked for a minute. No, it's a big deal, just like the Keane deal. That was massive. I just don't want him to sign a pre-contract agreement abroad now and go for $206,000.
Yeah, I think that'd be a shame. The latest is that there's another rule that says he can sign a pre-contract. Not an actual pre-contract agreement, but what is in effect a pre-contract agreement with a Premier League club if it gets ratified by the Premier League. And that would mean that we basically sell him and then his registration gets transferred when the transfer window opens or something like that. I think I've represented how that works. And it looks like it will be Liverpool.
I love this rule.
Yeah, that's pretty spot.
That rule effectively means that
you just sign anyone when you want.
Yeah, the whole transfer window is an illusion anyway.
It's totally pointless.
What's the point? Why are we all sat here?
Exactly.
Argued for an hour over it.
The club just made that big fuss about, actually, it will be against the rules to loan him back. It's basically the same thing. We will buy him, but don't get him until the summer. Is it not the same thing, in effect?
I don't know.
They're just calling something.
Yeah, I guess it's one end by doing that, by paying for him now to get around the whole tribunal rule, which may go in our favour, get us a lot more money.
Yeah.
So they offer $5 million now, but Bedez, I'll snap your hand off at that. And they avoid any potential dodgy add-ons and stuff in the tribunal. Yeah, so.
And it's not just that. I think people are asking why Liverpool would want to get him in now. I think if he does go on and score another 7 or 8 goals, there's going to be a lot of clubs wanting him, and to be able to nail that down in advance and know that you're not having to get involved in what won't be a bidding war because of the situation, but what suddenly reduces your chance of getting him if clubs like Man City and Spurs are going to be interested. It's been talked about Real Sociedad. It's easier to get out of that bum fight and get it all sorted, and I'm sure Danny Ings himself would rather it was done, as much as he said he just wants to play for Burnley until the end of the season. I'm sure he'd rather it was all sorted out and didn't have to think about it anymore. So yeah, I think it's a U8 agreement or something. It sounds made up, this thing Liverpool are trying to do, but I think it is best for everyone all round if it's done as soon as possible, because I think Ings will stay focused. I just think it needs to be settled.
I don't think we've seen much evidence apart from Saturday that Danny Ings is the type to get his head turned and switch off almost. He seems not only like in his game, but he seems quite personally devoted to improving himself and getting to the highest level he can. And I think he'll probably realise, because he seems quite an intelligent person, that the best way to do that is to keep performing and keep trying and ultimately do the best that you can for Burnley Football Club.
Exactly. I mean, people said, like, if he's already sorted out with Liverpool, why would he keep trying for us? But it's a question of professionalism and attitude, and I don't think Ings has ever had a problem in either of those departments. So I think we can have every faith that he's going to carry on giving his all, and we'll just write Sunderland off as a bad day at the office because it was in all the papers and a much bigger story than it has been, even though the speculation has been constant. We'll have to round off at some stage because we've been going for about an hour already, so we should round off, but we'll talk briefly about the West Brom game on Sunday that we touched on a little bit earlier in the podcast. Michael, it's been the same team for 9 Premier League games in a row. You've got to imagine after Sunderland, Dash is going to make changes. He's got to, hasn't he? Not that he's got any new players to put in.
Nah, it's going for records, isn't it? keep playing it, keep playing it, keep getting records. It'd be interesting to see what team he names. I'd like to see maybe one or two changes. Arfield, probably drop out for me. Cartley come in. I can't see much beyond that, although I believe Ward's nearly back to fitness. So if he's ready to come back in, I'd like to see him reintroduced for me, because he's not been up to scratch. They're about the only couple of changes, maybe. I'd quite like to see Ings and Fawkes paired up again, just because that's what goes to the Premier League, essentially, them two playing together. So it'd be interesting to see if they come back together.
And I think as well as Barnes has done, I think he has gone off the boil a little bit. He missed two really big chances on one at 0-0 that could have changed the game. So maybe switch it up a little bit, see if there's anything else there. On Ward, I don't think he's played a development squad game yet, so he's probably a little way away yet. But yeah, I agree. The sooner we can get him in for Ben Mee, the better. Someone suggested that West Brom might try and nobble some of our players at the weekend, knowing that we've got no cover in certain departments. Tony Pulis is obviously a very canny operator, but I think that's probably maybe pushing it a little bit.
I can imagine Warnock doing something like that.
Oh yeah, if it was Neil Warnock, we'd be like, oh God.
We'd all be praying, ah, no! But no, I can't imagine a manager purposely sending a team out to cripple another team. It's a bit beyond the pale, isn't it? That type of thing.
Yeah, even if it wasn't anything serious, just try and put someone out of the game. I think it's sort of 80s style football tactics, and I'm not sure anyone would try and do that these days, but it's maybe something to keep an eye on. Adam, what are you expecting from Sunday's game? It's another big one, isn't it?
It's hard to call, really. You don't, especially because although we kind of hit some form a bit ago, and now we just seem quite useless. It'll be interesting to see if we can pull it out of the bag, because what Sean Dyche teams have shown is that when you expect them to fail, they don't fail. So maybe because we all expect them to, I suppose our expectations have been lowered, maybe that means we'll beat the expectations and get a result.
It's a big test for Dyche, isn't it? I mean, it's passed pretty much all the challenges we've had so far with flying colours, but with the last couple of games obviously not going our way and Sunderland being one of our worst performances of the season and the disappointment of not being able to add anyone on deadline day, I think being able to put everything like that behind us and get up for what is a massive game. I mean, the next game is always the biggest game of the season, in my opinion. That's a cliche that is actually true, but in this case, with the games that we've got coming up, I think it's absolutely vital, and I do think it is a must win. I think if we only get a draw, it's not a disaster, but I do think it could be costly come the end of the season.
Do you know what the only silver lining is to all this, is that there is 3 teams in this league that are a lot worse than we are.
Yeah.
QPR cannot win away from home. The last time a team went, I think it's 11 games without away from home without winning.
6 years ago or something, isn't that?
Yeah, I think it was Sunderland 60 years ago. Leicester just look all over the shop. Even with the new signings, I don't think that's going to be enough. Aston Villa can't score for Toffee.
Yeah, they're awful.
I imagine them getting sucked in. I tipped them for relegation first day before the season had even kicked off. I can imagine they go this season. So we might just survive on the pure fact that there's 3 other teams that are far worse than us. Hull aren't much better either, so it's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
Transfer window's been properly rubbish. I've hated every minute of it, but it's not the end. And 3 points on Saturday, we're all going to be singing, we're all going to be happy. And it'll all be over. We'll all be like, I forgot about that transfer window of rubbish. And,
what transfer window?
Yeah, what transfer window? We've got our team's well good. So.
Our team is well good. So like 1990s.
Yeah.
Wicked. So.
Yeah. So the other subplot that's obviously worth mentioning is that we did get hammered at the Hawthorn. So
yeah, it'd be interesting.
I think that does always play a part. The players who played in that game will want to prove that it was a bit of a one-off and put that behind them, even though it's a different manager and some of the same players. And I think that does have a factor in Dash, especially will be keen to get one back on West Brom, I think. Well, to round off then, we will do our usual predictions. Michael, we'll start with you then. Sunday, noon kickoff at Turf Moor, Burnley v West Brom. What's your call?
Eternal optimist as ever, despite what's happened. And I'm going to go off for 1-0 home win.
Eternal optimist. 1-0. What about you, Adam?
I think I'll counteract everything that I've said in this podcast and say that we're going to win 5-3.
5-3, bloody hell.
Big Sunday thriller. Whoa, yeah, one
super
for the dads.
Sunday.
Yeah. I think it's a difficult one. I think the early kickoff is, it doesn't suit either side really. I don't think players really like playing that early. I think it'll be a tight game. I think Pulis will probably set his team up to come for a draw. So to counteract Adam's thing, it's going to be a goal fest. I'm going to say it's going to be 0-0. We'll leave it there.
It's so negative, Jamie.
I'm trying to be balanced so much. I'm trying to be balanced.
Keep it together, man.
It has been a mammoth podcast. So thanks to everyone who's stuck with us for the whole show. Thanks to Natalie, Michael and Adam for joining us as well. And Stephen from the Sunland podcast, Wise Men Say. Thanks to our sponsors at Neville G. Thanks to everyone who listens. If you do have any feedback, please do get in touch. We're on Twitter at NoNeverNets, where you won't find any gifts for a little while. I think we'll leave that behind for a while after Andy complained about them. And you can always email us as well. The email address is podcast@nonenever.net. Please do get in touch if you've got anything to say, especially if it's nice. But that is all we've got time for this week. So thanks again for listening, and we'll be back next week. Goodbye.